Krishnamurti Group Meeting, Saturday, 17th
January, 1976. In the Western world, Krishna gave a pretty significant statement way back in August 1929. The truth is a pathless land. If it is a pathless land, does that signify that it is omnipresent? There's no need to go on a path. Truth is where one is at any moment, anywhere in the world. This is how I myself feel about that statement, that it is an affirmation of the universality of this reality, which is omnipresent. And if it is omnipresent, it cannot be finite, it cannot be particular. No shape, no size, no limitations. See, some of these statements have a significance and an immensity of content in them, which must necessarily influence human beings for centuries and centuries to come. We get an idea, therefore, that a statement like that, that truth is a pathless land, is one of the eternal verities. If it is eternal, it has neither beginning, nor proceeding, nor ending. And if it hasn't any of those three, it belongs to a realm which utterly transcends other realm, other sphere of awareness, which is in terms of finite particulars and beginning and proceeding and ending, but does not exclude our realm. Nor does it, in the English sense of the word, include our realm. It completely suffuses, it completely permeates our realm. You see, the tremendous force of a statement like that. And I would just like to relate it something else. How did people in ancient times express this same fact? In their statement that God is omnipresent, the omnipresence of that which is named God, a sound which is indefinable in a dictionary. The omnipresence of God means the omnipresence of what we may translate in any other such transcendental terms as truth, or goodness, or beauty, or love, or wisdom. See how the great teachers, the great spiritual teachers work. They are awakeners. They awaken us to a new dimension of being, new to us, but which is and always has been and always will be there, which is always here. Now, it is this kind of awareness, this kind of consciousness, which is the thing that is slowly, slowly emerging in the human race. You find that all the great teachers did precisely that. Every one of them. This is what is so significant, isn't it? This transformation of our own awareness from its limited state into the unlimited state. And the words limited and unlimited must not be interpreted quantitatively, but in terms of a quality of awareness and nature of awareness which expresses this transcendent awareness. Why do you think it is so important for people like us who gather here to see into this completely, as completely as possible? Because it is this kind of awareness, this kind of consciousness, functioning through individual men and women, which is the supreme power moving the progress, the development, the coming to the unfolding of life on this planet, our world. We don't know this. That is to say, exceptionally few people really know this. As I said before, the very word consciousness is a curious word. We know what a liver is, a heart is. We know what a thought is, a feeling is. We know what a mental process, an emotional process is. And we say we are conscious human beings. In sleep, in dreamless sleep, we are unconscious. We can be knocked unconscious by a fall or an accident or whatever it is, and so forth. We know all that, and there is a certain precision of meaning to the use of the word being conscious. But consciousness is something which is the undefinable. You can't pinpoint it. What is this mysterious thing, consciousness? And yet, it is for us a supreme fact, consciousness. It is as supreme a fact as a word like Brahman or God or the Absolute or Truth or Reality, or Krishnamurti often has said, the immeasurable. The benediction of the immeasurable will be with you, and so on. Whatever word we use, consciousness is as much a fact as any of those other words. Therefore, if those other words have stood for the supreme, mysterious, unknown, ungraspable power, this creative power which functions throughout the world, and brings about the whole world process. Our consciousness is of necessity completely related to this power. In fact, it is this power in actuality. If one can sense, really sense that it is this power in actuality, we free ourselves a little bit from the usual limitation in our minds that consciousness is a mental phenomenon. It is something immensely greater than a mental phenomenon. It is an absolute, all-containing reality. It is the absolute, all-containing reality. Now, since man, in his life, in man's life, consciousness is this subtle, behind-the-scenes, absolute power which moves man's life and gives rise to his desires, his thoughts, his feelings, his words and his actions, and so on and so on. Therefore, it is extremely important that we move towards being able to live animated by this kind of consciousness, unresisted, unhindered by us, by our defilements and so forth. We talk about these things. What do we do? How are we conscious throughout the day? See, our consciousness throughout the day functions time and again as if it was in little poisoned bits. Anger, annoyance, reactions, upsets, excitements, elations, exaltations, the whole caboodle. We take to yoga in order to become fit, healthy, beautiful, all the rest of that rubbish. Forgetting the very first statement about yoga. Yoga chitta vritti nirodha. The chitta vritti. This one transcendent consciousness, hindered, spoiled, split up by us into a thousand poisoned fragments. Chitta vritti. And it is this stormy ocean surface, and a stormy ocean surface with froth and foam and horror and pain and something which will drown us, kill us. It is in that we live.
Present. In one way, I suppose, this is all we can learn from this fragmentation, which is fact.
This is our school.
Strange thing.
Well, consider this simple fact of our living experience, everybody's living experience. Why do we go to school? To learn that which we do not know. To learn that which we are not capable of doing skillfully. So, this is our school. All the evil things are the expressions of unskill. akusala kamma,
to use the Buddhist terminology.
Punta punta. As the modern man in the street in India might say, everything is topsy-turvy. That's a very gentle term. But look at the way in which this unskill in us has been on the upgrade for at least 20 years now, all over the world, and is destroying human beings, destroying values, spreading evil like a ghastly tide. Tide of poisoned, filthy waste matter. What do we do about it? We concern ourselves with organizations, procedures, processes to hold up the tide. We can't. That is not the way. For the one who can penetrate into the depths. There are only a few, relatively few, however, who can dive into the ocean depth where it is still and peaceful. Even there are submarine currents. I can't say subterranean. There are submarine currents take you hither, and so forth. And yet in the deeps of the ocean is the stillness, whatsoever the storm on the surface. In the deeps of consciousness is this absolute immense power which is unconcerned with time, with effort, with space, with particularities. It has to be, otherwise it cannot be transcendent. It cannot be the everlasting fount and source of life and the absolute good. And life is the absolute good if we don't restrict it to the purely biological meaning of the word life. So you see, there are all these things. This transformation of our mode of awareness. I use this phrase almost ad nauseam. You've heard it 1,000 times by now, if you've heard it once. But this is the thing to be done. Because it is this which is the hidden, subtle power, which is the irresistible, invincible power that brings about change. We get caught up in this sad situation, this sad outlook of, but when will it be? Today, tomorrow, 10 years' time, not in my lifetime. What is my lifetime? Nothing at all. It doesn't matter a crap whether I lived 2 seconds or whether I lived 2 million years. Because if I ever touch the core of that inner transcendence, in 2 seconds, an immense energy is let loose, which will bear fruit in bringing about good. Jerusalem, if you like, in England's green and pleasant land, could be a reality. See, we've got so conditioned by time and space and limitation and size and shape and results and sense sensational pleasure. We are the slaves of sensational pleasure. This is where our difficulties come. Think of the extraordinary beauty of the simple life process. The extraordinary beauty which contains both the pleasurable and the painful, the state of ease and the state of strain and struggle. If I allow myself to be the victim, the slave of pleasurable sensation, of comfortable sensation as my criterion, then pleasure and pain, ease and stress will be in everlasting conflict, leading nowhere but to the grave. But if I will wake up inside, this extraordinary inside awakening, if I wake up to that, then both pleasure and pain which come within the ambit of my daily experience are transmuted into something eternal. They become the expressions of eternity, of that which has utterly transcended death, as we ordinarily experience it and regard it. This is the kind of thing that is the power that brings about the transformation of the external shape of things also. How do you think a great creative genius manifests his maturing process? You take the earlier works of all the great creative geniuses and listen to the later works. And even a simpleton like me can see the process of maturing in the genius. The early efforts of the creative artist and the works of his fruition and utter fulfillment. You see the difference. Transcendence, in the later works, as only implied in the earlier works. The earlier works show the promise, the vision of the supreme peaks. The later works are on the peaks themselves. They're the fulfillment to fruition. How is that? What is the change which takes place in the creative genius? The transformation of his mode of awareness, this indefinable, indescribable, ungraspable content of the later works is the expression of this same content of his consciousness, which has undergone the transformation. Transcendence has come here. The city of God is on earth. Not just a promise or a vision. Manner in which we are aware. Krishnaji says, truth is a pastless man, omnipresent. Here, now, every moment, every second. You see, the difficulty, one of the difficulties we face, it is embodied in the question we ask. How shall we know that this transformation is born? You never can know. Whatsoever you can know in a specialized, particular, clear-cut sense is limited. It has immediately lost that dimension of transcendence. The dimension of transcendence is now only implicit in the particular. It is with your unknowing that you know it is there. Which means that you are it. You haven't got to strive to reach towards it anymore. You are it. You have become it. And that which you have become, you don't need to define. You don't try to define. Supposing we take a really absurd scenario. When I was 8 and 9 years old, I thought, now when I am 12 and 13, I'll be that tall. And mother, when will I be as tall as father? Big as father, you see? And so forth. All right, when I became as big as father, which I did, we were the same height. So the whole thing vanished. I had become it. You see, it's like that. Now, of course, the simile is absurd because here this is the realm of the measurable. But we are talking of the realm of the immeasurable. The release out of the prison house of finitude into the infinity of transcendence. And the marvel of that infinity of transcendence is simply that just here and now, right now, is that infinity. And whilst, in a sense, the word infinity contradicts the word finitude, in another sense, it is identical with finitude. And that is the transcendent sense, which therefore you cannot know, as you can know the finite and the particular, through the senses, the brain, the logical intellect. You have gone beyond it. You see what you and I are, each one of us, in potentiality. The vehicles, the living vehicles for the manifestation of transcendence. This is man's destiny, each individual being. Nature, who is Mrs. Transcendence, prolifically produces countless millions of creatures like you and me. One here, one there, comes to fruition. And through the ages, transcendence embodied, that supreme power, which in its mysterious way changes and alters the posture of things throughout the planet. We don't see it. There's no point in having any blind belief about it. But if this change inside one's being takes place, and the mind has some degree of training and clarity, training not restricted to mere conditioning, but training in the real sense, inward freedom and clarity, freedom to put aside all fixation. See? Then, as the thing happens in consciousness, the mind will know that this is the case.
Even our own individual fixations, other people are very easy to see. Our own particular.
See, why do we ask such questions as when will it be, how will it happen, will it bring about a good result? Such questions. Have you ever wondered why we ask such questions and what is the implication of such a question? I am self-interested.
Yes, I want a bigger and better self.
And to be self-interested fundamentally implies that I have separated myself from totality. I can't be self-interested if I'm in union with totality. How could I be self-interested then anymore? Because the defined self-interest is a thing which separates out that which is the self-interest from everything else. I'm in the state of sin. In the real meaning of the word sin, the sundered sin. This intense mindfulness through the day, ceaseless mindfulness, at first it will imply effort, because the organism through which mindfulness functions, if this organism were dead, that's the end of the story. There's no mindfulness practicable. You see? The organism gets tired. It has its limitations. And when it gets tired, it begins to slacken. It can no longer be mindful. And when the necessary chemical processes take place in the region of the back of the brain and so forth, you wake up and you start to say, oh my goodness, my mindfulness went. I was not attentive. I wasn't alert. And then is the great opportunity to learn and develop the faculty of poise and unself-concern with achieving. This is important. Unself-concern with achieving anything. All right? Never. Failed in the effort 10,000 million times. Well, there is always the 10,000 million and one time. And 10,000 million, billion, trillion more opportunities waiting. God's universe is infinite. I can always fill my cup to overflowing. With this reality, with this wine of life, this invisible wine of transcendent power, energy, beauty, truth, then you will have real enthusiasm with that wine, enthusiasticos. filled with theos, with God. That is the enthusiastic one. The one who is filled with transcendence. And if it is real filling with God, real enthusiasm, it is everlastingly pure, simple, free, poised, unobtrusive. It is not frenzy. That is why all these miserable cults and so on with their frenzied performances and shoutings and yellings and flingings about, and oh, the vast lunacy of Earth's most beautiful and wonderful child, man. You see, do we feel a sense of urgency?
No.
I think, as Derek said last time, I think I'm right in saying it was Derek or Greta who brought it to our attention. The reason that realization in this sense reveals us is because deep down inside of us, we're dishonest. We want always to hold on to that part of us which we like, which we think, well, that fits all right. So we're not prepared to open ourselves completely. We're frightened. The terrible fear, as Christian James said time and time again, you fear the known and you also fear the unknown. So we get left in the state of conflict all the time, of what is and what should be. And very few of us are prepared to just remain as, just as he says, look at the fact that we are in a confused state. Thank you. But even that you're not prepared to do, even that we are not prepared to do, because to actually look at yourself as you are in your confused state and to see it means that, if one understands what Krishnamurti says rightly, is to give up your suffering, to give up all this. But we can't even stay with that, because we... You see a little bit of it, and then we immediately go back to what we're used to. We're used to know.
We're
used
to know. We're frightened.
We're going to be better. Good.
What is the future? Not here and now. You say the emphasis on here and now. In a way, here and now, us sitting here, it seems in a way so obvious. Tomorrow, or the next day, in the world, this again, of course, is an excuse, we're deluged. Why? Our staying power isn't very good. Our staying power in the world is against sitting here,
yes,
in the, doing a job or whatever. We seem to be overthrown over and over again. We're lost. And then perhaps in a quiet moment, then perhaps we wake up a little bit. But one should. But one should be able to do this throughout one's day in everything that life brings up. But it doesn't happen. Not very often.
You know, it is very much related to this point, that it is a case of caring rightly for the right thing. There is only one right thing, and that is the total thing. The total thing is transcendence, is God, is the perfect, the absolute. See, Krishna, he, in his way, I should very much doubt whether he does it deliberately. Of course he doesn't. He does it naturally, because he is it, you see, brings this out all the time. This caring for transcendence, for reality. The ultimate truth, the ultimate fact. And see what his central point is. Pay attention. Be attentive. Because in this kind of uttermost attentiveness, what has happened? In this uttermost attentiveness, transcendence has become a reality. A reality in this kind of meaning of the word reality, derived from res, rei, that is genitive case rei, meaning a thing. Transcendence thingifies itself. It is transcendence embodied. And if you and I can pay total attention to it, then the communion is utterly perfect. The transcendent reality alone fills your attention, which includes description of every finite particular. It is there. You can't figure it out analytically and intellectually. You mustn't try to.
So this is prose. This is what he means so often when he says thought has no part to play in this process. Mm. It has a right thing, but in this it has no part at all.
You read my thoughts actually, because I was thinking this happens more often than we are actually aware of. But we disturb it because our thinking process stops. But in those silent moments, that really is transcendence. You wake up in the quiet of the morning or the early hours at peace. And then your thinking apparatus takes over.
The rock one goes, but there is the work is returning.
I wonder if you'd agree with this analogy. It's interesting, but it seems to be like this because it's impossible to get at what we are trying to get at with words, since we, by definition, words are limited and concrete, though they are pointers. Well, there's an exercise, if you try to think of a half without any numeral, without any object at all, but there is a reality of a half, but it is not connected with any heap. You can try to figure it, it's very difficult, and that way, this we can't grasp what we are.
What is that word you use?
Half! Just the notion of half.
One over two.
We not to be to get the idea, but not to picture it as one over two, or
half a book, or half a
you mean minus any form or symbol?
Yes. That kind of, but there is that thing which is awful, the reality of.
Because you always attach a concept to
it. Yes, and so it's so difficult, and that is difficult to get an idea of ourselves or something like that. Do you think that is bullshit?
Well, the Japanese have tried that way, haven't they, with their Zen, with their kan, when they say, what's the sound of one hand clapping?
I
see. It's exactly the same.
Yes.
Yes.
throws, I'm very interested in what you said, because, you know, one can have, as I expect you all have, by the time we've gotten to age, you have experiences of this sort of quietness and awareness. It is perfect. And I have found that it's not a question of accident or forgetting oneself. I will deliberately introduce thought. And I watched myself doing it. And it's almost a perverse desire to be on a lower plane than the gift that one has. I can see that I am deliberately doing this in a perverse way. And it's almost frightening because one is not accepting the great gift which is there.
But it's your fear, surely, that makes you... No,
I don't think it's fear. I don't know. I think it's a sort of laziness.
Or whatever it is, it must be related to something.
Sin, yes. It gives one a sense of sin and one still does it.
Do you feel that it might be like the little naughty child, you know, who deliberately tilts the soup plate in order to spill the soup over the new tablecloth?
Well, I think that there is a feeling that this is a most perverse, stupid.
You yourself said perverse.
Yes.
I'm taking that for granted that it is perverse.
Yes, well, I think it may be something like that.
And if it is deliberate perversity, it is somewhat like that.
Yes, yes.
Well then, perhaps it's related to some sort of frustrated childishness in you. The quality of childishness.
Mm.
I'm not referring, meaning a particular event in childhood
or
a particular situation.
Mm.
But just this.
I just wondered, in fact, whether if one does have this experience or this gift, but the mind does say, well, you can't be sort of sitting here daydreaming, if that's the correct expression, you must get on with the business of living. And thoughts, therefore, do compel one to snap out of it, as it were, and therefore one has this essential conflict. The business of living must be
gone. Because it's not daydreaming.
But you think, I know it's not daydreaming, but that's, there is that sort of lurking suspicion, I think, in the other part of one's personality.
That produces that in your mind.
Yeah,
because with awareness one gets a greater awareness and also greater energy to do what needs to be done and keep this attention. One can be quite active while one is aware.
One works and operates with a wholeness, which is lacking without this realization.
Surely you can't operate at all except with thought in a sort of a functional role. Thought just to do something. It's only when thought moves out of its purely functional role that in fact you do get the trauma and the new neuroses set in, when it moves out of the truly functional role that it has.
Well, you function, your thought comes into operation, obviously, intelligently. And it doesn't always operate intelligently. I'm not being personal, I'm talking about myself. Am I right in saying this? There is an intelligence behind that thought which is now operating as a whole and not even mechanically, as so many people use, or to say, as so many of us say, oh, hello, how are you? They don't care to root how the person actually is. It's simply customary to say this, to pass this off.
Conventional noises.
Conventional noises.
Jim, you said that we have to get on with the business of living. You see, this phrase and several other phrases like it have certain implications. Does the phrase betoken a mind in which there is
at least unconsciously, a separation. This is the transcendent, this is the business of living the everyday life. But this is a fundamental error. Look, let me go back to this word care and caring. In our group meeting here, Sunday before last, were you here? No, you were here Saturday.
Friday.
Yes, you were here on the Friday. In our group meeting here, Sunday before last, I started off by saying, if we really cared for religion, there is nothing else in the world we would care about or care for. Now, of course, the statement sounds horrific. What? My children, my loved ones, etc., 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 101 things will come up. Then I expanded that statement, you see. If I care for religion in the true sense, the full sense of the word religion, I care for everything in the universe. Because religion and the religious consciousness is something in which all other separated consciousnesses are subsumed. They are all subsumed in this one all-embracing consciousness. This is the religious consciousness. You see, religion is not a thing which is finite, which is limited, which is separate. It is the totality, in fact. Religare. To relate back. To relate to what? What can any particular finite thing be truly related to in eternal safety and well-being, but the totality? Isn't that so? I mean, even intellectually, logically, one can see that as completely true and unassailably true. Eh? Right. It's a business of living, means that in the course of the day, the routine of the daily life of the organism involves the contact and experience throughout the day with different particular objects, persons, activities, ideas, etc. All of which are limited and finite. But now, if the religious spirit absolutely infuses one, the whole of one is attending to the particular and the finite. And in the fullness of that attentiveness, the religious spirit fully manifests through the particular thing. This is, you see, this is the real meaning of virtue, Jim. This is transcendent virtue. Soul strength, the power of the soul. And the power of the soul derives from the one universal power of the mind, this creative energy, this creative action in eternity. That the transcendent is the root of the moral imperative in us. See? We don't need to think about it. We don't need to sort of say, I must bear in mind God as I am working. No, you can't do it. What you'll bear in mind is merely a picture. Either a gentleman with or without a beard, either white skin or black skin, depending upon the color of one's own skin, and all the rest of it. You see? That's all nonsense.
I think the sort of pitfall on this is that we're so conditioned that when this question of consciousness comes up, we make false analogies in life. For instance, if I am driving a car and trying to work out a mathematical problem at the same time, and the pedestrians around me are in great danger because one process starts, the other one stops or doesn't function. Mm. Now, you can't make this analogy with...
In fact, the figures of the people around you don't correspond to your figures. And so there is a mess.
Well, we do this, don't we? We make the sort of the life analogy. I think all of it is
So if there is this passion, this real passion, this absolutely undeniable passion, which will not, cannot take no for an answer, and which will never be given no for an answer, if there is this transcendent passion using you, then whatever you touch, you feel, you say, you do from moment to moment, from the time you have your breakfast, go to the office, and see your client or your customer or whatever you do in your office and so forth. If this thing suffuses your whole being, you don't have to sort of try to hold it. It is there permanently. You see? The beloved is everlastingly present here and transcendentally. The positive and negative aspects, the male and female aspects of transcendence, are in timeless conjugation. I have used that phrase in the new book. And this is not original to me. I mean, the phrase is, you won't find it anywhere else in this connection. The phrase is original to me, but the teaching is there. It comes way back from the Adam and Eve, from the early chapters of Genesis, through the Upanishadic teachings. It is in the Zarathustrian teachings. It's in the Hindu teachings. You find it. It's in the Buddhist teachings also. I mention Buddhism especially because if there is any one religion which outwardly seems to cut out women more than any other, then it is Buddhism. But what do the Dhyani Buddha, how are the Dhyani Buddhas, the supreme representatives of this creative energy of the universe as such, you see, how are they portrayed and represented? As in timeless conjugation, in the statues they are there. And of course, the dear missionaries who went said, oh, horrible, immoral people these are. They are in union, physical union. The timeless conjugation of the male-female, the positive-negative aspects of transcendence that produces this perpetual manifestation. So, when you or I pay total attention to any one thing, that is the realization of this timeless bliss. Whatever the external sensational expression may be, in terms of pain and stress, or of pleasure and ease.
And Michael, what Freud has explained is really the basis and the inner understanding of this much abused and much misunderstood Zen teaching. Mm-hmm. Because when our dear teachers, with all due respect, say, oh, well, when you sleep, and when you wash up the dishes, you only wash up the dishes. Yes, but how do you wash up the dishes, and how do you sleep? That is never explained. And it is seldom explained that this word chan, this Chinese word, means complete and absolute attention and awareness. Meditation. Well, if you take meditation in Krishnamurti's meaning, this is exactly what it is. But am I right in saying that they very seldom explain it as the level that
you really... Well, I'd better have a go, hadn't I? Since I belong to the Buddhist Society and I study a very interested student I am. And it does seem to me that, in listening to this afternoon, that we meet in full flood whatever is in front of our very eyes, whatever confronts us, what we think, we feel, we see, we hear, it's met in a sort of flooding of consciousness. And in that intensity and flooding, one doesn't think whether it's any good for the person concerned or bad for the person, for me, or anything. It's all that's gone. The flood is so supreme. And it takes over so completely. Really, no room for questions. If one acts in wisdom, one doesn't know it. if one acts unwisely but doesn't know it, these words do not occur. So, in washing up, that is how it is done. In sleeping, that is how it is
done. Total attention.
Yes. Mm-hmm. In the gathering of flowers, the people would say how miraculous, how wonderful the pain of water is.
When it is time to the end, just press the pause. But when it is coming to the end, don't get it run clean.
It's interesting to think that when one is relatively aware, you don't ask such a question, what is the reason for this, or why should I be doing this? This becomes a completely senseless question, which one would normally ask. As another, it doesn't occur.
Take this question of caring again. I mean, there's an enormous amount involved in it. You can't make yourself care. You can release the locked up power to care. I talked in terms of the word care. What is the very first of the Mosaic commandments? I hope I'm right in saying this. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and all thy soul and all thy might. Heart and soul are synonymous terms, really. The word heart in the old scriptures stood for the essence, the core, the most secret, the most perfect part of what you're talking about. And whenever they use the word heart, particularly in the Upanishads, Hridaya, whenever they use that word, it simply means the very essence of mind. You see, and soul similarly means mind. All right, with all your mind, and with all your power, your strength, your energy, love the Lord thy God that way. You care for that, and from that emerge all the other nine commandments. Have you looked? Mm-hmm. Have you looked carefully into the commandments and see how they emerge from this as the primal source? Look at the Buddha. What are his first words to his disciples? Hearken, because the deathless has been found. Transcendence has been realized.
The commandments start with saying, I am the Lord thy God that has taken me out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. That is how it starts. Then it says, you shall love your earth. You see, first it makes a statement, I am, and you just said the same thing about Buddha. The very same thing. And first of all, it makes sense that it has been found. I am. And it's also interesting, right, in the Hebrew, the I am, but there is no present tense in the Hebrew language. You cannot say I am in the Hebrew language. You can only say I. But there are two expressions for I, two definite words, which both mean I, except the one that is used is the one that implies the becoming rather than the being.
Ehiye is the word used in Exodus.
The I am that I am, that's translated to mean where the Moses went in the... That means that is the future tense.
The future tense.
Uh-huh. It implies of the idea of becoming
And the other word is
There is ani.
Ani. Yes.
But there is also anochi, and the one in the Ten Commandments is used for the word anochi. That's the transcendental one, isn't it?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't really know. I only know the two words, and that one is used there.
You know, Sholem writes very beautifully about this, very simply and succinctly in his studies in Jewish mysticism. This very thing, starting with Ein and becoming Ani. First it is He, and it ends up with I. For so many years now since I looked through that. Let's look at it again. Thank you for telling me this, telling us this. This is, this is how it comes in Exodus, isn't it? And then come all the commandments. Chapter 20, isn't it? So this caring, is locked up inside us. Why do we seek love? Why can't we ever stop seeking love? We seek love, and we as we are seek love because we are so confoundedly ignorant and stupid. Do I seek my ears or my nose? They are there. Take a little child as it is growing up. It knows it has feet. It knows it has hands. It knows it's got a face when it looks in the mirror. A very little child. For instance, your little James, who is precocious and so advanced, that's why I'm taking him as an example, with your permission or without your permission. That's the same thing. You see? Does he know he has a brain inside there?
No.
Ah! Excellent. Thank you for your support. You see, we don't know that we have this eternal, absolute love, this transcendent reality right inside us. But we go looking out and seeking for a full of love. We are led astray by the net of pleasant sensation. Mother and father fondled and caressed and cuddled and kissed and so forth, you see. And that is in the forefront of the mind, in the surface layer of the mind. And it gave a very pleasant sensation. So we go seeking that and call it love. Always misspelled. N-U-V or L-O-F or some such rubbish. But L-O-V-E, we cannot spell. Because it's the hidden transcendent reality, eternally there. So we go seeking that which does not need any seeking. All that is necessary is to let it be released. Watch the defilements which prevent that transcendent reality overflowing. It will never compel you. Love never compels. Wisdom never compels. Transcendence never compels. Do bear that in mind. God doesn't dole out rewards and punishments. The devil does that. In order to keep everybody on the hop, gives him great pleasure, doing it. But God never does that. Why not? If I, God, were to punish you, man, I'm punishing myself.
But surely, God is very merciful in this respect if He allows us to seek it.
Oh, precisely.
To intensify the search to such a degree that it will fall dead at our feet. And he then tells us he never will find it.
Well, don't you think also that we all feel unwhole? There's a kind of missing thing. I go through life looking for the other half in all those electronic things that you
look. That's a very, very important and a wonderful thing. You know, the Eros Psyche myth is a marvelous creature there. Our consciousness is a split consciousness. Inside, outside. Self, not self. If I were God, if I am God, if I am the totality, in my vision there is no inside, outside, self, not self. There are no unrelated duals. Everything is just one total reality. An absolute total reality. Therefore, because there is this peculiar stir inside, and because of my ignorance, and because my ordinary consciousness is overridden with this idea of self, not self, inside, outside, and my ordinary experience always makes me seek for things in terms of seeking outside. You see, finite things are always outside this thing, aren't they? Therefore, I go out seeking for the other half, the soulmate and all that. When one sees into that activity of the mind, that mistaken activity, then one ceases to go outside again. If only people, men and women, young people particularly, will never go out looking for a boy or a girl. The right boy and girl have a much better chance of coming together in their own natural and sweet time. And they'll be much better off and much happier.
And really it's because we don't care enough for God that we are all of us in this bondage. We don't let him take us out of the bondage.
Awaken to this transcendent reality. Just awaken to the fact. One awakens first by being told. One only hears about it. One can't otherwise.
But you have to find all this stuff for yourself, because we are not educated, we are not guided as children to into the right direction. And there we are, we're lost. We arrive in the other world as lost.
For me, that is one of the supreme tragedies of the human race.
Yes, it is.
We are born of parents who are not worthy to be parents. We are taught in schools by teachers who are not worthy to teach. This is a great tragedy. What do Mr. and Mrs. Father and Mother throughout the world, I'm just talking of the whole human race, what do they know about upbringing? They have not the slightest idea, the slightest sensitivity to the fact that this thing which has been born is transcendence and body. The pure, the perfect, the wonderful, the marvelous, the beautiful. This is God. This is God. Don't look back. You see, if you really wake up to that, and you wake up to, now what has prevented this being fully God, free God? Eternity manifests through time. Use my favorite phrase, eternity riding on the wings of time. What is there that prevents it? Ignorance. This is the supreme avidya, avidya, and so forth. First, one is told this, one may read it, and yet you and I all know from our own living experience, we read it, we get an intellectual sensation, this is it, he's got the truth, now I've got the truth because I've read it, I've heard, Jimmy Brown tell me this is the truth, and I know it is the truth. Now, I've got the truth, I'm all right. Very next moment, I go and kick that dog who it was in my way. Transcendent love.
Who is it on this? There's something on love and caring, something very peculiar about Christianity, which we've noticed either Brock or wherever, talking or around the table. At first to me it was a bit uncanny that he has no friends.
He has no?
He has no personal friendships.
Hmm.
He has no favourites.
He has no?
No favourites. No personal friends in that sense. Now, Dorothy Simmons, he will call, he never calls her Dorothy. It's always Mrs. Simmons. The only people that he uses a Christian name with are the children at the school. And this is one aspect. One has also seen him when he's talking about, shall we say, Vietnam. And his face goes quite grey. And he says, "Can't you see the pain and the suffering in this world?" And these two things together. And it's very interesting. Here is a fantastic compassion. It goes over you almost in a way, even to me. But not having personal friends at all, in a sense.
Couldn't have said no friends because he's everybody.
No, exactly.
This is as far as your experience of him goes.
Yes, as far as my experience. It seems
but
like...
But how did he address Raja Gopal and Mong Ji and
Mary
Latians and Ruth Roberts and Rosalind Williams?
In the past, yes, this has happened. But as far as one can see, there's been...
But if he met Raja Gopal now, he says, Raja.
Yes, of course, yes. Beryl certainly seen this aspect. You used to worry me.
No personal friends?
No, I'm not thinking of the main aspect at all. But I think it's quite extraordinary.
What? That he has this compassion?
No. The two things together.
Oh, you think that's something? Well, Esther says it's only because, I mean, you are assuming that he does this, but Esther says probably if he met Raja Gopal, it would be Raja. Yeah. If Mary was Mithika, it would be Mary.
Yeah.
I don't suppose you would call Mary Lucky and the Honourable Mrs.
No, honestly,
no. Probably just a no personal relationship with that, wasn't it?
Yes. Because, of course, one could see what would happen if this was going the other way.
You know and I know, and those who've been closely connected with Brockwood and Krishnaji know there have been enough emotional upsets to last Krishnaji to the rest of his days throughout his history. So, I mean, I don't blame him that if he doesn't want to make personal relations. Really, why?
The forms of address which a person uses, calling a person by his Christian name, or saying, dear so-and-so, or my dear so-and-so, okay, or whatever it is, completely lose all their ordinary significance when a person no longer differentiates between one living creature and another.
Yes, those are the lines.
Then that's
totally.
Yes,
that's
good.
I mean, nobody gets up and says, "Mr. Krishnamurti, may I ask you a question, please?"
I I've heard that too.
Have you? I've never heard him addressed as Mr. Krishna
Murthy.
Not
really.
Yes. Accepting that it is interesting that the name in itself, if we are our name, has an extraordinary power and ability to unite. Because there is a difference when that address is put that way. And I think much of what we have said today, particularly for those who are still in this jungle in which we have to earn our living and our livelihood and take and make decisions, is the basis of being in the world but not of it, which is what Krishnaji has said many, many times. It is the depth of understanding, as I understand it, that gives one the ability to face these storms and to see through, sometimes with not only the horrors, but the sheer hypocrisy and superficiality of these worlds, which can't be reconciled, but give you the ability not to become contaminated by them. You can only transform them by being transformed yourself. And if you're not a part of the rubbish and the dirt, and I am now a part-time worker for an enormous organization, you manage to contribute and contribute something of value without becoming marked with it. And you will understand, Muriel, because you too are on this vast government combine. I'm sorry, Chris, I didn't mean that.
No, I think the biggest imagination would, I've caught myself on this sort of thing, that, if only I could be free of the nonsense of life, earning one's living, then, of course, I could achieve something. And, of course, then one sees through the absolute idiocy.
Well, in order to be free of the nonsense of life, I have to be free, first and foremost, of myself, who am the biggest nonsense of life.
But at the same time, I think you've got to have time to sort all that out, haven't you? And if the nonsense of life, the pressures are overwhelming, there's no space in which to sort of let things settle down and sort themselves out. I think this is the trouble with modern living, that there is no space. We aren't able to create it.
How many times people spend in front of a television set? What about that precious summer holidays? They wouldn't go with us if we killed them. I won't have that about modern life. I don't think it's true. I think the pressures are very strong because everything's gone into the mass. The mass presses hard. But if there isn't the time, I just think I won't have it.
Yes, at the same time, I think when you are so involved in one respect, have so many pressures, then there isn't time to see that there is time, and so you take the easiest way out.
Just to escape from
the there's all the balancing thing. You come in and say, collapse before the television, switch it on.
But I think the difference, what we haven't learned, is this fact that you can live in different, not just levels, because there's
spheres,
yes, because you see, all right, we all have to do a job of work during the day, and I agree, I come home feeling absolutely wet, but what we don't do, which we can, is to switch that off. But we let it drag us down, you know, go on, says I, oh, I want to go to bed, or as she says, sit in front of the television. But it is possible to switch that off, I think, when I have done so and tried so.
As long as you remember.
This is where you're killing it.
I mean, if you catch yourself coming into the front door saying, God, I'm absolutely flat out. All I want is a drink, and television, or bed, and television, or whatever, you know. If one catches oneself there, that's the time where one can switch from one to the other.
This relates very much to the simple fact that the organism gets worn out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the organism is like a machine in certain respects. In certain respects it is like a machine. If you want the machine to last out a 100% life, then you must always have it properly oiled, properly this, properly the other. Then if the machine is calculated to last out 100 years, it will last for 100 years. Otherwise, it will last less and less because certain things were not done for it, you see. The organism is a little bit like that. It gets tired, it gets absolutely worn out. Well, come home and flop into your chair and just rest. And breathe for a few moments. Shut your eyes and breathe for a few moments. Let this rhythm re-establish itself. And if the organism is sufficiently tired, it will just go off to sleep. That's what used to happen to me after school. During the last 2 years of my teaching career, last 3 years nearly, of my teaching career, I used to get so tired out. Age, you know,
you can't help it.
I used to come home and I'm off in that very chair in which you're sitting. Just about 20 minutes and then I'd wake up refreshed, you see. I mean, I used to get so tired that I couldn't even take a cup of tea or anything. I just knocked and let go. And then came to again. One must recognize that. One must allow the thing to happen. Because you see, when I stop fiddling about, it gives transcendence a chance to work. How is it that you wake up in the morning recharged with energy if you've had a restful sleep? Roughly a proportion of 5/7 of your sleep was dreamless and 2/7 was dreamy. That's the rough proportion for ordinary mortals like me. And that 5/7 of dreamless slumber, the word I has vanished out of this microcosmic universe.